Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Respected elders, brothers, sisters in Islam, Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi.
I'm going to begin this afternoon's proceedings by painting a scenario for you. I want you to imagine that there's a situation in Northern Ireland where there is a bus full of Catholics and Protestants. An extreme group takes over this bus, deciphers the Catholics from the Protestants, and then shoots the Catholics at point blank range, and you end up with over 30 Catholics dead. It's an extreme denomination, neither Catholic nor Protestant. What would the international response be? What would be the response when it comes to the media? Would there not be an international outcry on the government to take action to prevent such things from taking place? Would there not be campaigns to approach the UN to prevent such killings from taking place? If there was just one incident, it would rock the international community, and indeed it would get a huge amount of media coverage. Such scenarios in Pakistan are not scenarios but realities that take place on a regular basis. There is media silence, there is silence when it comes to the international community, there is silence from organizations such as the United Nations. There is silence when it comes to the Muslim community, and when it comes to the Shia Muslim community, there is apathy, there is silence. Indeed, if we as a community do not wake up and take decisive action by at least acknowledging what is happening in Pakistan, Pakistan will become a role model for other states, a role model of how one can oppress and suppress and persecute a community with absolute and utter impunity and with a complete lack of accountability. Indeed, only this morning, a car hit a bus. Individuals going from Quetta to Iran, and 35 people at the moment is the latest count that have been killed. And again, this is a common and everyday occurrence in Pakistan. Therefore, it is most apt that we are discussing this very important topic this evening with a most esteemed scholar. Sayyid Murtada Ali Zaidi is a graduate from the Seminary of Qom. He is a writer, a lecturer, and political analyst. For over 16 years, he has been involved in various tabligh and humanitarian activities across Pakistan. He is a trustee of the Ilm or Amal Trust that has a range of projects, ranging from orphanages to hospitals and to schools. So inshallah, we shall begin his address with Sallu ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad.
Allah. صلى على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم صلى على محمد وآل محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين والصلاة والسلام على سيد الأنبياء والمرسلين حبيب الله العالمين أبي القاسم محمد اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد وعجل فرجهم وعلى آله الطيبين والطاهرين سيما بقية الله في الأرضين. First of all, I would like to thank Allah Almighty for providing me this opportunity and providing all of us this opportunity to discuss this issue which is happening with a big number of Muslim community. You can imagine around 170 million people living in Pakistan and going through these events. And I would also like to thank those who organized this gathering and the organizers of the whole event. In my speech, which will last for around 45 minutes, I will try to explain the historical background and the steps which were taken on this historical background which led to this situation in Pakistan. Though it's a big story, but I will try to cut it short, and then we'll come to the analysis of the current situation and then a few results which we can extract from the current situation. Then the important, more important part will come, and that will be your question and answer, and we will try to explain the points which were left from the address in the question and answer session, inshallah. Sallu ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. صلى على محمد وآل محمد وأجل فرج. You know, the area which we are talking about is Indian subcontinent, and Indian subcontinent is historically influenced by Persia, the Iranian side, and Afghanistan. And in the initial time, it was influenced through sea by the Arabs. What were the initial reports of people coming from Arabs? It comes to the early, very early time of Islam, at the time when Bani Umayyah was following those who were following Ahlul Bayt, and they used to come to subcontinent, Indian subcontinent, to get refuge here. The first Arab army which invaded, particularly for their own reasons, you know the history, it has different reasons to explain, but we can say this might be one of the reasons, because the leader who guided the army and who supported the army, both were very very much involved in this event. You can imagine Hajjaj bin Yusuf sent this army, and you know very well how was Hajjaj bin Yusuf and what was his agenda at that time. He sent an army guided by Muhammad bin Qasim, a youngster, and he came to send through the area which is now called Karachi, and he entered through this gate, and they went up to Multan, and they captured a lot of cities. This was first presence of Arabs in this region. And then it opened the door for others to come. Next big invasion came from Ismailis. It is surprising that the Ismaili government, which was in Egypt, and they were called Fatimid, they sent their troops, and they sent their people, and they came to subcontinent, and they started their own government, which was in Multan, city of Multan. Now, you can see, right from the starting, it was not because of religion to spread, and because of invitation of Islam to be given to other people. It started with wars, and unfortunately, it started with some sort of clash between sects. It started with this mentality. I can't say that this is the main reason that we are still in this problem, but okay, this is the background where we started. And because I have only 45 minutes to explain and too many points here, so I will skip quickly coming to the current situation. So this was the starting. We had three main groups right from the starting in the subcontinent. Later on, a big turn came in 16th century. 16th century was a crucial time for Muslim history, when there was Ottoman Empire in Iraq and Safavid in Iran and Mughals in India. And the Mughals were somehow lying between Safavid, those who had recently announced Shia, being Shia, and Ottoman, those who were traditionally a Sunni state. So Mughals had a strategy to get aid from Safavid, pledging that they will announce Shiaism and they will favor them, but they used to get army and they used to capture cities in India and forgot what they had pledged. We have different account of this compromise between Mughals and Safavids, but unfortunately it also paved the way for further escalation of tension between different communities. Twice Iranian army came to India with the first person, Mughal emperor, that was Babur, and then Humayun. And this group stayed in India. This was, I may say, first big population of Shias, those who were residing in India. But major powers remain in the hand of kings. They used to have alliances with other kings. Babur and Mughals had alliances with Safavid. And whenever this alliance used to break, there was a problem in India between sects. And I think a very good example can be seen at the age of Aurangzeb. Aurangzeb was a king from Mughals, and he had requested Iranian king to send him army for his help, but the Iranian king denied, and as he denied, Aurangzeb realized that I have no support to get, so I have to go towards extremism. And he went towards extremism, and a big massacre of Shias started in India. At the same time, there were other explanations for this traditional sectarianism. Sallu ala Muhammad wa ali Muhammad. So I was telling you that at the time of Aurangzeb, there was a conflict between kings, and that resulted in a massacre and sectarianism in Pakistan, in India. That was India at that time. But there were different explanations also. Before Aurangzeb, there was a very big king, very, very prominent king, and he was Muhammad Akbar. And in the court of Muhammad Akbar, there was some sort of leniency between Muslims and Hindus. And in the court of Akbar, there were many prominent Shias, and they were Iranians. Someone say and explain that this has given excuse for extremists to come in. And they said because of the Iranian influence, because of the Shia influence in the court of Akbar, they started what we call now a propagation institutionalized in the form of sectarianism. So the first person who rose against it was Ahmad Sarhindi, and he issued a fatwa that might be the first fatwa in the history of Muslims of subcontinent, and he denounced Shia and started his preaching in a popular institutional style. He wrote a book which was Radd Rawafiz. At that time, they used to speak and write in Persian. So the book was Radd Rawafiz, and Rawafiz were called, Shias were called Rawafiz. And then that kept on going with Ahmad Sarhindi establishing this trend, and his time was 1564-1624. And then it started. Ahmad Sarhindi was the first person, then Shah Waliullah, then Shah Abdul Aziz, and later on in different shapes and styles, it kept on going. At the time of British government, when British came to India, it was already been done. There were too many sects, there were too many institutions, but further institutionalization of sectarianism happened at that time. So around 1860, we had Barelvis, we had Deobandis, we had Shia, and we had Qadianis. And of course, we had Ismailis also. So I'm talking about 1860, and at that time, 150 years back, all the sects had tensions, and all the sects had institutions, already had institutions. I can say somehow British enhanced them. I can say it, and because we don't have time to prove this and go into the lengthy discussions. But you can go through a book. It's a very good book recently written, Sectarian War by Khalid Ahmad. It's a good book. You can go through it and you can find the history there. And regarding the Mughal era and Safavid era, there is another good book, Indian-Iranian Relationship, written by Dr. Riazul Islam. So these two books can give you an insight regarding the history of sectarianism in the Indian subcontinent. At the time of creation of Pakistan, there were different sects. I told you there were Barelvis. Barelvis are a sect of Sunni Muslims which are closer to Shia. They have regards for mystics, for Irfaniyat, and they have regards for preachers. They were called Sufis in Pakistan. But against them, there were Deobandis. Those were close to Ahl-Hadith, and they were close to Wahhabism, though Wahhabism was new at that time. But slowly and gradually, it was coming to India through those ulama who were going for Hajj and pilgrimage to Makkah. And when they were going to pilgrimage, they were getting ideas from Wahhabiyat, and it used to come in India. At the time of creation of Pakistan, we had differences, and we had institutionalized it, unfortunately. But a new factor came in, that was the establishment of Saudia in Hejaz. And through this establishment, they penetrated India, and the social fabric, which was up to that time was not that good, was influenced by them very badly. And sectarianism started growing in Pakistan very deeply. In some of the areas, with the sectarianism, in some of the areas, people were living in peaceful manner. Sunnis and Shia were going to get together in Azadari. It was very common in India up to that time. And I can tell you, a province in Pakistan, that is Balochistan, it was very popular for Azadari, that everyone could have come together and they were doing Azadari. But after the appearance of Wahhabism through Saudia and their followers and preachers, it's ruined, and now we can see Pakistan, that shape which we have now. But after the creation of Pakistan, one more thing happened. You know, the creation of Pakistan was done on an ideology which was called Two Nations Theory. It was an idea given by a few scholars in Pakistan. They said that we have two nations. First is Indians, that were Hindu, and we, the Muslims. They said, because we had two nations, we have to be divided into two countries. That idea was promoted by Muslim League Party for Muslims and guided by Muhammad Ali Jinnah, and it was opposed by Mahatma Gandhi, and the party was Congress, which opposed them. But later on, Muslims were convinced that Hindus are not going to give us the right, and they switched to Pakistan, and Pakistan was established. I'm not going to tell you that it was that a good step or not, but the theory, which was two-nation theory, that was relied upon. And they started working on this theory to prove that we Muslims and Hindus had differences. During this process of establishing this theory, they allowed a few people to write the history. Pakistan was created, and they needed a new syllabus for their schools and colleges. They allowed the scholars to come in and write the history. But when they were writing history on two-nation theory, unfortunately, they dignified those scholars who were against Shias also, not only against Hindus, but also against Shias. So much emphasis was given to Ahmad Sarhindi. Much emphasis was given to Aurangzeb Alamgir. Because why they did that? Because they wanted to prove that Muslims were separate from Hindus, and that's why they wanted to prove that Ahmad Sarhindi was good. He fought against Hindus. But the same Ahmad Sarhindi had fought against Shias also. I don't know who and with what intention they did that, but this route was established in Pakistan. I started my education in Pakistan, and I remember myself studying all those figures and dignifying them, that they were true Muslims as it was portrayed. But later on, I came to realize that those guys who were portrayed as very dignified, very pious, in fact, they were rewarded for their statements against Shia. All those who were dignified in Indian and Pakistani subcontinent syllabuses, books, and Islamic history, unfortunately, they were much against Shias too. Now, I have named a few for you, but this concept has got rooted in Pakistanis. They have learned their history through sectarian eyes, and unfortunately, afterwards, we could not control it. We could not correct it. The biggest change, I think, came at the time of Ziaul Haq. And it was in 1979 when this change came. Through Afghanistan, Russians invaded Afghanistan. In Iran, we had Islamic Revolution. And at that time, clash of interest got involved, and Pakistan was the main battlefield for this clash of interest. So from one side, we had Iranian Revolution and a lot of people trying to stop and you see, making barrier in the influence of Iranian culture going to eastward, that was India and Pakistan. And historically, it was proved that whatever happens in Persia, it used to come to India. So they were afraid that Iranian Revolution would have an influence on Pakistan and India. They had planning, and the planning mixed up with the invasion of Russians in Afghanistan. So at least four planners got involved in Pakistan and India, especially in Pakistan because it was close to Iranian border. First one was the Pakistani government, which was guided by or led by Ziaul Haq, who himself had very much tendency towards sectarianism and going towards Wahhabiyat. He got help from American CIA, those who were trying to fight a war against Russians in Afghanistan. Saudis also came in, because Saudis were fearing that Iranian influence will come towards Pakistan and they will lose the battle in Pakistan. And at that time, you know, Saudis brought their money, Americans brought their strategies, and Pakistanis, ISI and army, everyone got involved. And unfortunately, Pakistan became a battlefield for all those ideas. And who were crushed in between? Unfortunately, the Shias. And generally Pakistanis. You can imagine thousands of madaris were established. Why they established these madaris? With two intentions. First one, they wanted to prepare jihadis for themselves to fight in Afghanistan. And second one, to stop the influence of Iran. So they prepared a lot of jihadis. I can tell you hundreds of thousands of jihadis, tens of thousands of madaris. And just to give an example, Pakistan spent $8 million of zakat fund on madaris. Officially they said, okay, we have spent that much time in a few years. So Shias, at that time, what Shias were doing? They were just looking that our country has become a battlefield, all the ideas, though they had a tendency to protect them, naturally, and they were inclining towards Iran. But unfortunately, they were not prepared for this battlefield. It was a game played by major powers, and a huge amount of money was involved. Shias of Pakistan could not tolerate or could not observe that shock. I remember that time, Allama Arif Hussain Husseini was the leader of Shias, and he used to point out that what we are planting these days, we will get it in the later years. Unfortunately, that thing happened. Russians went out, and Americans lost their interest in Pakistan, but whatever they had planted, it remained in Pakistan. Tens of thousands of madaris with their ideology going towards jihadism and unfortunately going against Shia because of the Saudi influence, and Americans left the country and Pakistan was free for others to play here for 10 years. For 10 years, we lost our central government. During 10 years, five governments were changed. And you can imagine what used to happen at that time. Then in 1998, Musharraf came in, President Musharraf, and Musharraf had a bit of strong central power. And he applied a type of U-turn in Pakistani history. And he said, going from jihadism back towards liberalism, he tried his best. But, okay, we need sincerity to guide a nation. And then when 9/11 happened, everything again came into the hands of Americans. Americans, those who had lost their interest in Pakistan after the Battle of Russia, they came back in, and this time with another agenda and with another view. And you know what happened? They invaded Afghanistan, they invaded Iraq, and all the battlefield was played again in Pakistan. So this was the case for Pakistan in history. And somehow we were involved in the battles because we were on the crossroad of history, and the regions were very important for players to play. Now, in the current situation, I can imagine at least 9 countries are directly or indirectly involved in this region. At least 9 countries are involved. A few I have named, and you can add, for example, Britain, British government, for example, Afghanistan, India already involved, and you can say Israelis and others, but it is a battlefield now. Everyone has weapon, everyone has deep-rooted hatred or his own agenda, and unfortunately there is no power in Pakistan to protect these conspiracies or these strategies which were played by others. 3 points I would like to especially mention here. Sallu ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. Sallu ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad wa ajil farajam. Unfortunately, Looking at these difficulties, I told you Pakistani Shias of Pakistan were not prepared for all these happenings. When all these things were happening, there were two tendencies which were planted in Shias, or they perceived that way. The first one was to go inward, and most of the Shias applied this tendency. They went inward and they wanted to become more Shia, and they wanted to have lesser links with Sunni community. And this, I think, flumed the already charged environment, and the sectarianism got more roots in between us. Second tendency was to go towards liberalism. Leave the religion and go towards liberalism. And third tendency, which was created here, is to go towards militancy. So there were three main tendencies which were created, or we perceived that way. First one is to go inward and become more and more isolated. Second one is to go towards liberalism and secularism. And third is to go towards militancy. All of them had owned their own problems. Sallu ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. So the Shias in Pakistan have a few fundamental problems. Number one, through the period of time, they could not establish their own institutions. I think this is one of the big problems. I was trying to skip all the historical backgrounds which you can learn from the books. I wanted to come to the analysis of why the Pakistani Shias are facing problem. One of the major reasons that we are having this sort of problem, because we could not establish our institutions. And it is unlike Iran and Iraq and even Bahrain and even Saudi, they could establish some sort of institutions for themselves, especially madaris. Or, for example, Lebanon, they could establish themselves. But unfortunately, in Pakistan, it could never happen. So, just to give an example, we have two main sects in Sunnis. First one is Deobandi, and the second one is Barelvi. Barelvi are more closer to us, and Deobandis are the guys which were supported by Saudi. Now, how many students they have in their madaris? It is roughly 2 million. And how many students we have in our madaris? That are roughly 11,000. There is no match. They could establish a lot of institutions for themselves, and unfortunately, we could not do that. Though we have started now a few good madaris, a few good university type of madaris being established, but we are far behind them. This is one of them. Second, because of lack of this academic background, still we don't have single personality which was agreed upon between all the Shias. This is the second problem. We don't have a clear-cut leadership in between Shias of Pakistan. And though we have leaders, alhamdulillah, but unfortunately, one person which was agreed upon by everyone, we don't have him. And this lack of leadership is another problem in Shias. Third one is ideological training, lack of ideological training. We are Shia, and we are doing our marasim, we are doing azadari, we are doing everything. But unfortunately, still the training which had to be given to Shias, we are lacking it. And in the absence of this training, every player can play with us. You can imagine an SMS will come and it will be circulated, and people, without thinking on the meaning, context, intentions, they will be influenced by such moves. So I think the third problem is ideological training. It should be given, and it should be provided to them. Fourth one is a roadmap, a clear roadmap. If we could not have a true planning, we will be deceived by those who are trying to deceive us. So I think going inward, one of the deception. Going towards militancy is another deception. And being liberal and secular is another deception. We have to see what our religion has taught us and how we should lead our life according to our religion. But unfortunately, without a particular roadmap and without a strategic planning, these are going somewhere else, which we need to address. So Here we are. I had 45 minutes to say, but I unfortunately lost a few minutes in the early, and then this mishappening, and I want to wind up here. So if you could have question and answer, and we can clear those points in question and answer. There were surely there were many problems which we can mention. Let me clear this point too, and then we will go to question and answer session. In Shia itself, they have many, many tendencies. For example, one tendency is going towards the concept which is called Ghali, being Ghali, that means raising the status of Imamah to a level which is going closer to, coming closer to Uluhiyat or the chain of God, or the line of God. So this is one of the tendencies. It might be created somewhere, and it has been planted, but okay, this is one of the tendencies, and I fear that in some of the parts it is growing. And the other tendency which I told you, this is traditional Shia, which has nothing to do with anything in society, which has nothing to do with what they call it politics, and be traditional, just observing their traditions. So there are a lot of tendencies in Shia, and they are also making problem for them. But beside all these things, beside all this background which I told you, and beside the problems which Shia face, one thing I can tell you very clearly, being in Pakistan for the last 16 years, working with them, and that is their pure heart. They are simple, they are less educated, they are less organized, but alhamdulillah, they are pure in their heart. They want to do whatever given to them in the name of Islam. They were befooled, unfortunately. Don't think that Taliban is single title. Don't think Taliban is one group in between them. There are tens of groups in Taliban. Some were fighting for this group, some were fighting for that group. But unfortunately, if you go to the general public, most of them are simple-hearted, loving people, and working for Islam. Sallu ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. So, and because of that simplicity, they were befooled. Because of that love for Islam, they were befooled, and they were thrown to whatever front other wanted them to throw in. So you go to Chechnya and you'll find Pakistanis, you go to Bosnia and you'll find Pakistanis, and you go to everywhere in the name of jihad, you will find Pakistanis. Why? They are everywhere. Because they love Islam, and they were befooled. So this is the simple equation which is being dealt in Pakistan. What is our responsibility? I think best what we can do is awareness. Raise our voice. Aware them what's going on. And as the brother was telling you, if that was the case in any other part of the world, there was a huge cry in media. There is nothing in Pakistan, and there is nothing in international media. Just 3 weeks, not even 3 weeks, we had a sit-in in Karachi. Tens of thousands of people remained on the street in the cold winter for 42 hours. None of the Pakistani media covered that event. None of the Pakistani media. They never showed anything, how people sacrificing their life to protect others. But they never given them coverage. So this is Pakistan. You have a very cruel reality in Pakistan, very complex reality, very complicated reality, with people who are very good, very sincere, very loving, but unfortunately unguided or misguided by others. So I hope with the sincerity which they had, which they have in their heart, and with the tendency for serving Islam, I hope there will be a day when Pakistan will be a true spirit of Islam. We need to work on it. We don't be misguided by the sense of sectarianism which was created in Pakistan, the sense of militancy which was given to Pakistanis, entitled. So if you name Pakistan, you will feel militancy and jihadism and sectarianism. But this is a title which was given, and I hope, as I mentioned, with the sincerity which they have, inshallah, we will have a loving Pakistan. Inshallah, we will have a peaceful Pakistan. A Pakistan which will be developed, inshallah. Sallu ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad.
We're now going to move on, inshallah, to the Q&A session. Of course, thank you very much to Sayyid Ali Murtada Zaidi for your very enlightening and informative presentation. Of course, you can ask any questions that you wish to ask. There are pens and papers going round, so you can write down your question. Inshallah, we will patch them through. Some questions were emailed to us prior to this event, so we'll start with those questions, and then once you have your own questions, we can move on to them. Sayyid Murtada Ali Zaidi, firstly, thank you very much indeed for your address. One of the questions that came through via email before this event is, to what extent is the government in Pakistan to blame for what is currently taking place?
Yeah, when you talk about government of Pakistan, this is a title again, which has many aspects to deal. Pakistani government is partially responsible for what's happening in Pakistan, because there are more powerful group in Pakistan than even government of Pakistan. So what we call government, a president, a prime minister, a parliament, they have more powerful groups in Pakistan than this setup. And that group may be army, and in army we have institutions, agencies, those are very powerful in Pakistan. They can throw every government, you know, in Pakistan. Most of the time we had martial law, we had the rule of army on the government. So not only government is responsible, but those agencies, I think they are more responsible for whatever is happening in Pakistan. And then third group is bureaucracy. In Pakistan, we have a very strong bureaucracy, which is playing with some sort of people in Pakistan. So government is logically responsible, because they are in power, they have the control, and they have the resources. But beside government, other elements are also to be blamed, and I think the best of the points should be given to, most emphasis be given to the agencies. Agencies in the army, agencies in the military forces, those are more responsible than government, but government is equally responsible.
In your presentation, you made reference to the fact that we need to create awareness in order to try and make a difference. If in Pakistan the government is not your standard government, as you would have in Western countries, for example, or indeed many other countries, where should the pressure actually be exerted when it comes to creating awareness on an international front?
This is, I think, first step to realize that not only the government is responsible, but other parties are also responsible. And I know, I can say this is not a fact which is in secret for them. If you talk about British government, they know it very well who is responsible and who is going to work in Pakistan. Everyone knows that. For example, in Britain, in America, in European countries, everyone knows that government is a puppet for them. But the real strength and the real power goes to those agencies and armies. So if you just talk to the government and say if they should use their influence on those agencies and talk to them that what's going on in Pakistan, they do it. It's not a new thing for us to teach them that in Pakistan government is not powerful, there is another group which is powerful, and you must go there. They know it very well.
Sure. Another question from the floor is, Shias today are being killed by those who claim to be Sunni. How do we preserve unity in these circumstances?
Yeah, I think, as I mentioned here during the speech, that there is a tendency between Shias to go inward. This is, I think, the worst solution in this kind of situation. We have to keep our relationship with Sunnis. We have to have contacts with them in every sphere of life. So this contact can remove the misunderstanding, those misunderstandings which are promoted by those guys. I'll tell you an event just a few days back. There was a guy who was, and 2 points here I should mention. There's a guy who was a leader of a militant group, and he was attacked in one of the areas of Karachi. Then he gave an interview after his attack, and he loudly, very clearly in front of news and media, and he said, I will make this city such that no Sunni will shake hand with any Shia. Now, they clearly telling their agenda. They are clearly announcing it. And all the media are watching that guy, and they don't dare to tell government or to themselves, why should we cover this person? Now, they censored this part of his interview, but it is available on YouTube. You can go and you can watch it. This is one. Another thing. Around 3 days back, there's a police officer which gave a very good report to ponder on, and he said that we collected 7,000 bullet cases from different events of sectarian killing. For example, a case from a Sunni, a case from a Shia, those were killed, and he said we collected 7,000 bullet cases. And going through the forensic report of these casings, he said in 90 cases, it was the same weapon which was used. In 90 cases, same weapon was used against a Sunni scholar, so-called Sunni scholar. Those might not be a good title to be given to them. They were Wahhabi, Salafis, and Takfiri group. That alim and another person, a Shia lady doctor and his husband, who was also Shia, they were killed. So in 90 cases, same weapon was used. So it is very clear that Sunnis, general Sunni majority, is not involved. There is a group which is doing this, and they are getting benefit of lack of awareness. So this awareness we should create.
Sure. Another question again from the floor is, how do we find leadership who will take the Shia in Pakistan at the level of Iran? In essence, in your presentation, you did make reference to the fact that there's a lack of leadership.
How?
How can we take the leadership in Pakistan and increase it to the extent, or empower it to the extent that it becomes like the leadership in Iran, where it's very clear and very decisive?
Yeah, I mentioned it that we were not aware of the complexity of the situation when Iranian revolution, Islamic revolution happened. We were not prepared for that thing. But everyone turned to us in Pakistan, and they made it a battlefield for us. I think we are slowly and gradually we are learning our process. I think there were no person in between a few years when the Islamic Revolution happened, and the main person who was leading us, Allama Arif Husseini, was got matired. But then gradually people are coming together in groups, and a sort of leadership is appearing now. But in my opinion, I think it will take time. It will take time for Pakistanis to realize and to learn the complexity of the situation and to learn the challenges which they are facing. So in my opinion, though we don't have clear-cut single person leadership in Pakistan, but we are on way towards unity, we are on way towards understanding, and I hope that the way we are going, and unfortunately pressures are also here from enemies, it will make us think better, and it will make us be united and following a single leadership. It will take time, but we are on the way.
Another question from the floor again. It says, when it comes to Sunni and Shia killings or Shias that have been killed, not necessarily by Sunnis, but by extremists, what is the position when it comes to Shias killing Sunnis in Pakistan? Number one, is this taking place? And number two, are we also speaking out against that on an institutional level?
Yes. Looking at the report of that police officer, which is a good document, I think there was some people from Shias who started this thing in the early times when it started. I think it was in late 90s when a few group of Shias were involved in this type of activity. But during last 10 years, I don't think so. I don't think that Shias were institutionally involved in this thing. And I think there is someone else who is playing in the name of Shias, as supported by this document. So in my opinion, there is no Shia group which is institutionally or organized in an organized way involved in the killing of Sunnis or other Muslims. So this can happen in the name of Shia, but it's not Shia. And if that happens, we are clearly going to denounce that, because in Pakistan, killing against killing never been a solution for anyone. Killing against killing. So one more point I would like to raise here. There's a simple thing to do. Kill someone and send a message to the community that, okay, your guy was killed. And kill someone else and send another message that said, okay, those guys killed your person. And this is happening in Pakistan. Very easily happening in Pakistan. So every time there's a person killed, you will receive tens of messages telling you that this has happened. And so you have to show yourself. So they are provoking. But I'm confident that right now there is no single Shia group which is involved in this type of brutality. And if it happens, we are clearly going to denounce that.
How can we have more unity amongst the Shia Muslims, not only indeed in Pakistan, but on a global level, so that when such oppressions do take place in Pakistan and indeed many other areas of the world, there can be a unified response?
Yeah. You know, this is very good to understand, and I know you can understand it, that this is happening in a way with everyone. It happened in Iran in one shape, then in Iraq in another shape, then in Lebanon in another shape, and in Bahrain it is taking place, and in Saudi it is taking place, in Kuwait somehow, and in Pakistan very clearly. Unfortunately, it is happening everywhere, and in Afghanistan also. So it is taking place everywhere. Here we need to have a good leadership at that scale, covering all the Shias of the world and telling them what to do. Unfortunately, in case of Pakistan, believe me, it's happening. Whenever I went to someone and told him that this is happening in Pakistan, come and have some solution, everyone realizes that this is a complex situation. Everyone says this is very complicated to do anything here. But we need to have an stance. We need to do something. You see in the Bahrain what's happening. And you can see everywhere. So this is a need for us to come together, leave our life, personal issues and botherations, and think for the higher level of your objectives of life.
And another question that just came through. To what extent do the political parties that have influence in Pakistan, such as Bhutto's party, they are Shia or have Shia affiliations, can they make a difference? And there's also a reference here to Imran Khan's party. Yeah. Is that a positive development?
Yeah. It was very famous in Pakistan in earlier times that Bhutto was somehow closer to Shia families, and his successors were closer to Shia families. So there were hopes in between Shias that they are going to do something. But if you look at this way, they are politicians and they are liberals in their minds. So I don't think we can rely on them that they are going to help us. I don't think, because they have their own political agenda. If you are going to vote them, yes, they can give you some sort of protection up to their own benefits, up to their own extent. And a time will come when they will say that, okay, that is enough, this is our limit, and you have to do it by yourself. So I don't believe in them right now, because I have seen them for last 30 years that they play their own game, and when it comes to us, they kept silence when we need their voice. And in case of Imran Khan, I can say this very easily, that if you go to his rallies and if you go to his parties, you can see a lot of flags of those parties which are militant parties and banned in Pakistan. They were announced terrorists, and they have full presence in the meetings and gatherings of PTI, Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf. So I don't understand the guy who is leading the rally. He's looking at those flags which are banned by Constitution of Pakistan, announced terrorists, And he can't dare telling them that you cannot appear with this banned institution or terrorist organization. So the person who is so lenient and the person who cannot take this stand against this terrorism, if he comes to the power, can I believe that he is going to do something? This I can't believe. This I can't understand. And the same thing happening with PML, Muslim League, and happening with People's Party. So at a point, and another thing, at the local level also, there are political parties which they say that we are going to protect you, but everyone has his own agenda. And one more thing I would like to add from the politics of Pakistan and our connection with the politics of Pakistan. For the last 60 years, unfortunately, we could not plan ourselves what should be our objectives in Pakistan. It should have been done right at the beginning of Pakistan. You know, many of the main founders of Pakistan were Shia. Muhammad Ali Jinnah himself was Shia. And other companions of Muhammad Ali Jinnah, they were Shias. And they were powerful. And they were working with a true spirit to help Islam and Muslimin and to form an Islamic government where everyone will live openly and freely. So they had good intentions. But unfortunately, we never planned for this thing. And we just allowed others to take the benefit, and then we have this situation. So I think we should have planned ourselves. Unfortunately, during those last 60 years, we only demanded one thing from political parties, one thing only, and that is you protect our azadari. That's all. I have gone through the documents. Even when a group of Shia scholars went to Muhammad Ali Jinnah, and Muhammad Ali Jinnah said, "Why you came to meet me?" They said, "We have a demand." And he said, "What is your demand?" They said, we demand you to protect our Zadari." And he said, "This will be a free country. You don't need to worry about it. You will be protected, of course, as everyone other Muslim will be protected." So I think this might be our inexperienced behavior, that we wanted a very simplified thing. Now, after being disappointed by all the political parties that they are not going to do anything, now there is another sense in Shias that, okay, Azadari is our issue and we are going to protect it by our own self. Biggest Azadari used to held in Karachi. And the biggest gathering is Ashura. And you know, some years back in Ashura, there was a bomb blast. And at that time of bomb blast, no one came forward to protect us. What happened? Our scouts who were volunteers to organize a gathering, just they remained there, and they protected us. So this is a very clear indication. You can't rely on any one of them. You have to protect yourself. If it is your issue, you have to do it by yourself. And again, I'm telling you, there is a fear that with this disappointment, Shia will go inward and they will forget their context with other world. And this is, I'm not going to appreciate. We have to do our duties by our own self, but we have to remain in contact with other communities. So we could remove the misunderstanding which were spread by people like those guys who said, I will make a city, no Sunni will shake hands with Shia.
In your address just now, you made reference to the fact that when it comes to these marches, etc., that there is no protection for the Shia or for Shias in Pakistan. One question that has come on the floor is that should we not actually make a legion or some sort of militia that would protect Shia Muslims in Pakistan, particularly when it comes to prominent scholars, prominent activists, such marches and such like?
Shia should
arm themselves, yeah, in order to form some sort, yeah, of, you know.
Now, I can understand this is a tendency in every community when it comes into trouble and no one going to help them, that they'll raise their own weapons. But as I mentioned, three parts which they are laying for us, one of them is militancy. They want us to be militant. They want us to be militant. And what will happen if we become militant? Shia will be a militant party, na'uzubillah, just as they are another militant party. So I don't want this happen. This happen with us, that they are killing and we are killing. We don't want this. And the and brother is not telling this thing. So we should be very clear that we should not go towards militancy. Now the other thing, we want to protect ourselves. What is the way to protect ourselves? I think militancy is not a good option. Militancy is not a good option. So we can use all the legal titles. We can use the titles which are legal in the Pakistani government, and through these legal titles we can protect ourselves. For example, one of the legal titles is security agencies. Security agencies. It is allowed. It is very much legal. So you can go and open an office for a security agency, and that security firm will give you guards, and you can keep the guards with yourself for your poor arms and for your personalities. But in my opinion, everything should remain open and should remain legal. So going inside will never be successful in Pakistan, because we are very few in number, and I think going one by one, it will always be a case of loss for us.
Another question again from the floor is, when it comes to the plight of the Shias in Pakistan, that there is often, there seems to be this neglect. It doesn't get as much publicity as other non-Pakistani causes do. An example is, if there's a march in central London, the only people that tend to turn up are those who are from Pakistan. But if, for example, there's a march concerning Iraq or Bahrain or such like, Pakistanis and indeed many other denominations will show solidarity. Why do you think that's the case?
Unfortunately, this might happen because of the routine of events which are happening in Pakistan. Someone told me from Scandinavia, he was living in Norway, and he told me something very strange. He said, once there was a blast in Pakistan, and it was in the beginning. He said, that day, whoever came to me asked me regarding that blast. Then the thing happened again, and he said the number reduced, and then afterwards he says, if something happens, no one comes and asks me what's happening, because it has become a routine for them that this thing is going to happen in Pakistan. Just like you see in Afghanistan, someone killed, and you never pay attention who is in Afghanistan and who is killed. So this is one of the strategies, that to make it acceptable, do it repeatedly, so it will be acceptable for you. So I think this is one of the strategies. If you could plan ourselves, we have a few cards in our hand, very few cards in our hand to play. So first we should identify what tools and instruments we have. Second, a logical utilization of all what is left to us. Very logical utilization. For example, sit-ins, rallies, protests, banners, these are the tools which we have, and we need to be very logical to utilize them and how to utilize them. So daily protests, daily rallies will not going to give us anything. It should be very organized, and it should be in a manner that it could make a difference.
Should the ulama in Pakistan affiliate themselves further with the Islamic Republic of Iran in order to provide and empower themselves with a greater sense of unity and direction?
Yeah, it's naturally it is very good, and we are already linked with too many people, and historically, historically whatever happens in Persia, it goes towards subcontinent. So naturally, it is a very natural historical tendency that ulama from Pakistan will go to Iran for ziyarat, for their studies, and they will have contacts. This contact can do some sort of benefit, but I think 2 points we should consider. Number one, our identity. There is a problem in the identity of Shias in Pakistan. Their identity is being attached with Iranians. So there is a case, a particular typical case in the court of Akbar, and in that at that time, in the court of Mughal Emperor Akbar, Shias were in the court, very influential, and a person was there who had some sort of biasness against Shias, and to show that biasness, he once came to Akbar, the king, and he said that all the Shias in your court are actually spies. He said, prove it. He said, do it, just single thing. Say, whoever are local go there, and whoever are Iranians go that way, and you will see all of them are Shias. This is an identity, a show of identity. Now, what happens in Pakistan, from Shias to and from enemies, it has been highlighted and it has been endorsed and it has been, you see, magnified, that we think that they can do something for us. So we look towards them and we depend on them. I think this should not happen. I personally have links with Iran because of my religious sentiments, because of my background. I studied there for 12 years and I have my teachers there. But if I want to deal issues in Pakistan, I should be on my own feet. I should have my own identity. Otherwise, no one is going to accept from me. So if you are going to work in Pakistan, first of all, pay attention to the people of Pakistan. Get their confidence first. If they are with you, you can do everything. But if you are looking somewhere else, getting benefit from others and trying them to solve your problem, you'll be able to solve your problem. So in my opinion, very clear, don't take it that way. I'm attached and I want to be attached because of my religious sentiments, because of my studies, because of my past and my career, everything. But to solve the problems, I should be on my own feet. I should be on my own feet. And this has nothing to do with unity between Shias or all the world. So if an incident happens in Bahrain, we come on the street to protest. And if something happens in Iraq, we come with all our problems, we come to the street and protest against that thing. But to solve the problems in Pakistan, you should be on your own feet. You should have your own institutions, you should have your own personalities, and you should have people confidence in you as Pakistani.
Thank you. There is an interesting question here where individuals, they want to make a difference, they want to protest, they want to speak out, they want to do everything that you've suggested through your talk by way of activism and protest and such like. But the question here is saying it is often difficult because they fear for their own lives, the lives of their families, if they were to protest on a grand scale. So when they go back to Pakistan, they may find themselves in a very difficult predicament. So therefore, how does one strike the balance? How does one sort of assess the importance of protest vis-a-vis one's own safety?
Yeah. As I mentioned, our protest should be very calculated. This is one of the instruments which we have to put pressure on somewhere. So it should be very calculated, it should be very logical, but if someone goes for a protest in England and he's fearing that if I go back, my life will be in danger, what about those guys who are already living in Pakistan? And they come to the street and they show their faces. Don't they putting their life in danger? Strange event in Pakistan during the last sit-in. During the sit-in, which took 42 hours around, there were men, women, children. At a certain time, the one who was announcing, he said, "Now I want all the men and all those who are at that side, be silent. Just women. And only those women, those who have children in their hand, just raise their children." It was a beautiful scene. So many women under sky, under winter, with pressure, with all the risk of life, they had their children in their hands and they raised them. This is a courageous nation. And the women are very important part of this courage. So person like me, I feel the problems, I feel the difficulties, I feel the historical background. But with this type of woman, brave woman, I am sure we have a wonderful future. No one can defeat this nation who has such brave women in themselves.
Sallu ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. And on that note, that brings us to the end of this afternoon's proceedings. We thank Sayyid Murtada Ali Zaidi for joining us. May Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala bless you and continue to give you strength to engage in all the good works that you are involved with, and bless you with the blessings of Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, indeed not only in this world but inshallah in the hereafter. Sallu ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad. There is an exhibition towards the back of the hall where you will see pictures of individuals of the shuhada who have been martyred in Pakistan, and indeed pictures of that will give you an indication of the plight of the shares in Pakistan. Much has been discussed this afternoon. We pray that it will be delivered with action more than anything else. Thank you to all those that have joined us. And again, we thank Sayyid Murtada Ali Zaidi for joining us. And we end with Sallu ala Muhammad wa Ali Muhammad.